friends. Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here with you this morning. Thank you for the invitation. This talk is really a prelude, or perhaps an invitation, to a workshop I'll be facilitating here on March 20th. The workshop is called Roots of Injustice, Seeds of Change Toward Right Relationship with Native Peoples. I'll hope to see many of you again here when we do this work together in a couple weeks. My talk today is mostly about the seeds of change and the leadership role the United Nations is playing in defending the rights of Indigenous peoples. The importance of this work and the urgency of it hit home very hard this week when the Indigenous leader Berta Cáceres was assassinated. Berta lived in Honduras, one of the most dangerous places on the planet, especially for human rights defenders and Indigenous peoples. Dozens of Indigenous leaders have been murdered there in the past decade. And Thursday they came for Berta. They came because Berta was one of the most effective and courageous opponents of corporate mega projects in Honduras. Mega dams, mega plantations, mega mines, mega tourist complexes, all of which threaten the ecosystems that Indigenous peoples depend on for their lives and livelihoods. I'd like to dedicate this sermon to Berta. In Latin America, when we lose someone in the struggle for social justice, we don't say in memoriam, we say presente. Please say this with me. Berta Cáceres, presente. Let's do that again. Berta Cáceres, presente. The organization that Berta worked with in Honduras has published a poster with a beautiful picture of her and the words Volveré y seré millones, which means I will be back and I will be millions. The series of events that led to my meeting Berta at the United Nations began during the 20 years I lived in Costa Rica, from 1973 to 1993. I lived on the Caribbean coast, and from my house it was a 15-minute walk, usually a very muddy walk, to the edge of the Kekaldi Indigenous Reserve. Today I'm not going to be talking about my life and work with the Kekaldi people, but I owe them a great debt of gratitude. They are the ones who taught me what it means to be Indigenous, how the world looks from an Indigenous perspective. Here you see Juanita Sanchez and Gloria Mayorga, who co-authored a book of Kekaldi history with me. Also shown here are Duaro and Kesuar, Kekaldi boys, who are feeding an iguana. When I am uncertain about the direction my work should take, I often ask myself, what would matter to Duaro and Kesuar? You could say they are my conscience. Now I'd like to turn to the United Nations. My first experience at the UN was when I was in college in the late 1960s. My college roommates were from New Jersey and Long Island, and they invited me to go home with them for spring break. As we were packing our bags, we heard the news that Martin Luther King Jr. had been murdered in Memphis. We were shocked and horrified and also very worried about what this would mean for our country with the loss of Dr. King's leadership in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and the poor people's movement. We drove to New Jersey that night, and the next day we marched with thousands of others through the streets of Newark in honor of Dr. King and everything he stood for. The next day, we went into New York City, and we spent the morning at the United Nations. Since then, in my mind, these two things have always been related, the UN and the social movements for peace and equal rights for all oppressed people and groups, as Dr. King advocated. Fast forward now to 10 years ago when I started visiting the UN regularly for meetings of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Every May, every May since 2002, about 2,000 indigenous people from every continent and ecosystem on the planet, the Arctic, rainforests, mountains, islands, deserts, everywhere, come to the UN headquarters in New York. For 2 weeks, they meet in the General Assembly Hall, where they report on the status of indigenous peoples of the world, their political rights, health, education, economic and environmental issues, every aspect of their lives. They come in business suits or in the traditional dress of their peoples. Young delegates, and there are many young delegates, come in t-shirts with slogans like, "I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I am changing the things I cannot accept." I was able to participate in the UN Permanent Forum meetings while I was director of a nonprofit organization called Global Response, which was based in Boulder. Kathy Partridge was a colleague of mine in the Global Response work. We collaborated with indigenous communities around the world that were fighting to protect their lands from exploitation by mining and oil companies. Many of these indigenous communities sent delegates to the UN Permanent Forum meetings, and I met with them to organize our campaigns. This is where I met Berta. And this is how I was able to get an inside view of how indigenous people are working through UN channels to exercise their human rights and to achieve their development goals. Indigenous people started approaching the UN in the early 1970s, seeking an avenue to redress their grievances against the nations that had colonized their lands. Wilton Littlejohn, a Cree lawyer from Canada, was a member of the first indigenous delegation to the UN. He had been trying to defend First Nations treaty rights in Canada, but he realized that all the laws were written by our colonizers, all the judges were appointed by their governments, and we would never get justice under their rules. So we went to the United Nations seeking an independent forum where our concerns would be treated fairly. The situation was the same for indigenous peoples all around the world, in all the lands that had been invaded and colonized by European powers centuries ago. National laws legalized the actions of the colonizers and did not recognize the rights of indigenous peoples. To understand this, we need to go back to the 15th century, when European explorers started discovering new lands, first in Africa and then in the Western Hemisphere. In 1452, Pope Nicholas V, Pope Nicholas V, authorized the European explorers to capture, vanquish, and subdue all pagans and other enemies of Christ, to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery, and to take away all their possessions and property. The popes and European monarchs created concepts like the doctrine of discovery, which held that Christian European discoverers could claim ownership of the lands of all the non-Christian peoples. As colonization progressed, these concepts formed the basis of colonial legal systems around the world, including ours. Attorneys at the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder point out that these racist concepts of European superiority are still embedded in our legal system and form the foundation of federal Indian law. As recently as 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the Oneida people's land rights, citing the doctrine of discovery as precedent. Indigenous leaders at the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples in 2014 said they see the doctrine of discovery, and this is a quote, manifested in policies and actions designed to destroy indigenous peoples, thereby resulting in the ongoing usurpation of indigenous peoples' lands, territories, resources, air, ice, oceans, waters, mountains, and forests. The destruction of indigenous people's political and legal institutions and cultures, failure to honor treaties, genocide, ecocide, loss of food sovereignty, and the imposition of, quote, development models that are destroying the life-giving capacities and integrity of Mother Earth. The fact that 370 million indigenous people exist in the world today, despite centuries of systematic oppression, is a tribute to their will to survive as distinct cultures, their knowledge of the ecosystems where they live, and their persistence in demanding their rights as peoples. Finally, the United Nations heard their voices and began realizing that the rights of indigenous peoples were not being protected under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They were not being protected by international law. The ongoing impacts of colonialism created unique circumstances for indigenous peoples that needed to be addressed by the world community in a unique way. So in 1971, the UN began documenting the systematic violation of indigenous peoples' rights. In 1982, it established a process for indigenous leaders and nation states to draft a UN declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples. From that point, it took 25 years for this declaration to reach the floor of the General Assembly. But on a September day in 2007, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples was approved with 144 votes in favor, 4 votes against, and 11 abstentions. To our shame, the United States was one of the 4 votes against the UN Declaration, along with Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. All 4 of these countries eventually endorsed the declaration with some qualifications. The U.S. was the last to do so. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is not a treaty, so it does not need to be ratified by Congress, mercifully, in the case of our Congress. The Declaration does not create new or special rights for indigenous people as individuals, but it does do something new. It recognizes the collective rights of indigenous peoples. It explains how existing international human rights instruments apply to indigenous peoples collectively. It establishes minimum standards that need to be implemented by each nation state through their own legal and social systems. The UN Declaration doesn't give rights to indigenous peoples. It recognizes the inalienable rights that indigenous peoples have always had and that have been systematically violated for centuries. So what does the Declaration say? If you want to read it, Google it. It's really a very instructive and important thing to read the entire script of the Declaration, which I will not do today. But I'll summarize it in a few main points. The right to self-determination. Indigenous peoples have the right to freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. They, and this is a quote, have the right to autonomy or self-government in matters relating to their internal and local affairs, as well as ways and means for financing their autonomous functions. They have the right to promote, develop, and maintain their distinctive customs, spirituality, traditions, procedures, practices, and legal systems. Nation states are required to obtain indigenous peoples' free, prior, and informed consent before taking actions that affect them. This right to free, prior, and informed consent is critical to indigenous communities that are trying to protect their lands against exploitation by mining, oil, and other transnational corporations. In several countries, the UN Declaration has already helped indigenous peoples win court battles. The right to land, territories, and natural resources. For many indigenous peoples, land is the fundamental basis of their cultures, their spiritual life, their integrity, and their economic survival. The UN Declaration requires nation states to give legal recognition and protection to lands that indigenous peoples have traditionally owned, occupied, or used for their subsistence. Economic, social, and cultural rights. The UN Declaration recognizes indigenous peoples' rights to health, education, employment, housing, and an adequate standard of living, and their right to freely determine their economic, social, and cultural development. It recognizes their right not to be subjected to genocide, forced removal, assimilation, or destruction of their cultures. They have the right to practice and teach their cultural traditions and beliefs. They have the right to be free from all forms of discrimination. The Declaration affirms that Indigenous peoples require recognition of their collective rights as peoples in order for them to enjoy their human rights. Their collective rights to their land and resources are equivalent to the rights of non-Indigenous individuals to their property. Treaty rights. The Declaration requires nation states to honor and respect treaties and agreements made between indigenous peoples and nation states. In the U.S., Native peoples are bringing attention to many treaties that have not been honored by the federal government. For example, the Sioux Nation's ownership of the sacred Black Hills. When James Anaya, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, assessed our country's compliance with the UN Declaration, he specifically directed our government to honor the Sioux Nation's treaty rights to the Black Hills. Closer to home, he also directed the government to honor its promise to compensate the survivors of the Sand Creek Massacre and their descendants, a promise the U.S. has not fulfilled in the 150 years since the massacre on the Colorado Plains. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is a great achievement, but it means nothing if it is not implemented. In our country, Native attorneys are looking at what it will take to remove all vestiges of the doctrine of discovery from our legal system and build a new system based on human rights. They know that Congress and the courts will only take action if the American people demand it. Amen. So, it is up to us as citizens to demand that our country live up to its ideals and offer justice at last to the original peoples of this land. Walter Echohawk, a Pawnee attorney who has spent a lifetime advocating for Native American rights, says that slavery and racism have been torturous detours away from our country's core values. He says, "The human rights principle has always impelled Americans to self-correct our shortcomings, sometimes at great cost, and to redeem our core values, which insist on the dignity of every human being. We're all called to do what we can to bring our communities and our country into right relationship with the first peoples of this land. At the Quaker meeting here in Boulder, I'm working with our Indigenous Peoples Concerns Committee to educate and motivate all people to become advocates for Native American rights. We offer workshops for adults in churches and other organizations and for middle school, high school, and college students. The workshops are experiential and they help people of all ages understand and acknowledge, maybe for the first time, the impacts of colonization on the Native peoples of this land. We hold a mirror to ourselves, our history, and our institutions. We ask how discrimination is being perpetuated today and what we can do to swing the arc of history toward justice. For the past couple years, we've been presenting these workshops all around the country, wherever we're invited. I'd like to close now with this reminder from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who has a deep understanding of the path from truth-telling to reconciliation and finally to healing. "Unless you deal with the past in a creative and positive manner, you run the terrible risk of having no future worth speaking of."